I wrote down barfy.
Everybody, we're Sorkin in it. Watching the newsroom, please take just a minute. It's a podcast. Aaron Sorkin might choose about Will and Mackenzie making the news. You're Sorkin in it.
Welcome back to Sorkin in it. I'm Brian Warren.
He really is. Oh, and I'm Lex Friedman.
Oh, good. There we go. I knew you were here. And yeah, here we are. We're here for episode 3 of season 1 of The Newsroom, which is what we're doing now. We're not doing the movies anymore. So
no.
If your podcast downloader of choice has skipped a few, we're not in movies. We're in TV. Everything's moving to TV anyway. Isn't that right, Lex?
I'm into that.
And the title of this particular episode, I believe, is the 112th Congress. That feels almost like a West Wingy title, doesn't it?
It does. And this is an episode that covers a really long time. And if you're not paying close attention, you may not even realize how much time is being covered. But we see the newsroom and the whole team working to cover the election run-up and then the actual election for the 112th Congress, which includes a lot of Tea Party candidates. And we see Will taking on the Tea Party. And challenge some of those candidates who are, for lack of a better term, dumb. And we see that story told in parallel with some difficult things for Maggie, some relationship nonsense with Mackenzie and Will and their own separate datings. And then the whole time we keep intercutting with Will's boss, Charlie, up in the executive suites, getting yelled at by the head of the news division and then the head of the whole company, or the head of the network and the head of the whole company.
Yeah.
The latter of which is Leona Lansing, played by an actress you might have heard of, Brian, named Jane Fonda.
Oh, yeah. I remember her from the workout videos.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What did you think overall of this episode?
This felt like a pretty Aaron Sorkin show. The thing I really enjoyed about it was the way that they really masterfully put in the pacing. You know, we're cutting back and forth to a real-time conversation happening on the 44th floor to like months of activity that's going and building and building, starting with just this Jerry Maguire on-air apology kind of thing to much later where he's basically like wanting to take down some of the richest people in the country. I felt like that, it felt kind of like what we signed up for with Newsroom. That's kind of what I was hoping to see. How about you?
I did like this episode certainly more than last week's episode 2. It got some of that episode 2 taste out of my mouth. But and I appreciated the playing with time, and frankly it took me a little bit to realize, you know, this meeting was happening after about everything we've seen.
Too.
Which I guess is a little bit intentional. I liked the episode. I have a bunch of notes on things I didn't like too and on things I did.
Yeah.
But that you referenced the opening apology. Will opens, you know, the episode of the news show with an apology about the failure of the media and of his show in particular to be better.
Mm-hmm.
I had a lot of feelings on it. It felt a little too preachy to me overall. And I really didn't like tying it to the Richard Clark 9/11 apology.
No, that didn't make sense.
Like to be like, hey, here's an apology that this guy made who had been the head of anti-terrorism, whatever, for the US. And he's like, yeah, 9/11 happened. I'm really sorry. I too am sorry that we have done a bad job on being better news reporters. Did not feel great to me. I did mm-hmm. not like that.
Yeah, that felt a little like a connection that was a little tenuous at best. It didn't feel earnest. It did kind of take a little bit of the wind out of it.
Yeah, it felt campy. Like Ernest went to camp, if you will. But I will say the meat of the apology is as true in 2023 when you and I are recording as it was when the show aired, I don't know, in 2012.
Yeah.
So a long time ago. I didn't even remember the story of the Times Square bomber. I was Googling that while they chose not to cover it in great detail mm-hmm. because they're like, it wasn't a thing. I didn't even remember that story.
No,
I had to read the whole Wikipedia page about it.
Which kind of it makes Will's point, doesn't it? That we don't remember it. It was non-issue.
Yeah.
It was just something to fill time. One very minor point that I had that threw me was that when Will writes this apology, I guess, at his dining table, and then I guess he like sends it to Mackenzie and I guess to the rest of the team, and then it starts waking people up. But Jim wakes up because it gets faxed to him, and he has a fax machine right next to his bed. That seems a little... I don't know where that thing came from.
Yeah, that feels dated even for 2012 to me. I don't remember faxing 10, 11 years ago.
And everybody else is answering it on their phones. So like Jim's the one with the fax machine.
Maybe Jim has like some super complicated setup where he automatically has emails from the boss get printed out on his fax machine.
It's the only way I wake up.
All that felt like even just Will reading it to them and them like loving every second of his saying, hey, we've kind of sucked. Like if, like I said, that part of it felt... The structure, the motivating, the inciting event for this episode felt a little bit hammy to me. It beggared belief is what I wrote. But I don't know. So I did get one. I was all snarky. I see it in my notes here where I was like, we're leaving Jane Fonda silent this whole episode, knowing what a powerhouse she can be. She's clearly going to build up to a powerful, inspiring speech, and this is being heavily telegraphed. It's well telegraphed. I'm still liking it, but it leads me to wonder if he's making her the new President Bartlett, is what I wrote early in the episode. Like, because Bartlett doesn't show up in the pilot of The West Wing until very late in the show, like till the end, and then he's like so impressive and gravitas, whatever, and he turns to be this great guy. But Jane Fonda's big speech when she finally talks is not, you're right, Will, go get him, Tiger. It's
a joke.
A joke that I didn't feel was like a great joke anyway.
No.
And she doubles down on it. She leans in again with that the pun. If you don't remember, you know, it's a joke about Moses and Jesus playing golf, and when Jesus has a bad swing, he uses his godlike or God powers to manipulate nature to get the ball in the hole. And Jesus says, "Do you want to fuck around or do you want to play golf?" And then Jane Fonda calls back to that line again when she, I guess, is implying that Charlie's not debating or engaging in good faith.
Yeah,
but it doesn't really play to me the way I expected it to. And like when she's saying like, Charlie, you're acting like we're speaking like equals, like I obviously we're not supposed to like Jane Fonda. I think that's the most surprising thing. I thought we were supposed to like Jane Fonda.
Yeah.
And then we really did not.
Yeah, because Charlie plays that role for us, right, where he's Will's boss, but he's like totally 100% behind him and like even pushing him outside his comfort zone. Like I guess you need an enemy in the network somewhere, but we already have that with Jane Fonda's son. What is she providing for us that we don't get with him? I don't know.
Yeah, that's right. Like, if she's just going to back up everything he says, then what's the point of, like, why not just have her?
Yeah.
But I don't know. I did really like Jane Fonda, the performer, but I did not like Jane Fonda's character, and I guess we're not supposed to. But there was another thing that I noted in this episode. So Philip Baker Hall shows up as ousted Congressman Delancey. I love Philip Baker Hall, and I thought he was great in this role. But this is the first time I really note the show mixing real and fake stuff in terms of the news it's covering. Because the Tea Party candidates that they're talking about who are terrible are real, and the concept of ousting, you know, lifelong public servants who have done a good job and reached across the aisle was real, but to have them as characters means they had to fake them.
Yeah.
And that is weird to me. Only in the sense that like it takes me out of it a little bit. Because now my brain is working to think, oh, is this a real news story or a fake news story? Is this a real person or a fake person? I guess once there's an actor playing somebody, then it's not real anymore. But I would just say it's notable to me that they're mixing and matching fake news and real news.
There's a lot of mention of people, and they use that like footage of other real life people. We did it a little bit, I guess, with the BP thing where we're like calling people on the phone who supposedly work for the government or work for BP and stuff. But in this case, bringing people on who supposedly just got ousted by this person we bring on who's just an actor playing a fictional character who just got ousted by someone who presumably would be actually a real person. It does end up making you feel like, should I be Googling this to find out who's real and who's not? Despite that, like the whole story is actually totally what happened 10 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think they're wrong to mix and mesh, but it's a very specific decision to say, let's cover real news stories, which I think makes sense and serves the show well, despite people having objections to it. But then mixing in the fiction with it, like, now it's like, well, then why do we have to do the real stories? Like, I get it, and I don't mind it, but it definitely, it is noteworthy to me each time.
This particular episode does bring me to a point where I realize this is why people hated this show. Like, this is, or at least half of America didn't like it. I mean, there's plenty of people on the left side of the aisle who probably just think Sorkin's too preachy or too high-minded or something. But then there's like, you could look at the first episode and say, like, regardless of which side of the aisle you're on, you know, we can all agree that America's too polarized, and we can all agree that America should do better by their citizens. When you get to this episode, it's like, he's calling half of America bad. Or at least if half of America finds themselves following these people and they don't really know why, he's kind of saying that they're idiots. And so that does put a little bit more of a pin on why this was a more divisive show than, say, The West Wing was.
I think that's right.
Now, I agree. And for many people, they can look at this and say, like, this confirms a lot of my beliefs, or why I feel like it puts in such a harsh reality why it is such a painful thing to see people follow the Tea Party, or see people follow the people who are even more to the right of the Tea Party. But if you're not fully thinking that through, it can be a lot more painful.
Yeah, no, that's fair. And, like, I will say this. I don't think that's why people didn't like this show. I think people didn't like this show less because it said, hey, half of you were... Because I don't think those people were watching the show anymore. Like, I don't think Tea Party fans were watching an Aaron Sorkin show. But, like, I think the show has a really difficult tone to strike. And I think... I mean, we're only three episodes in. I think so far it does okay. Like, I did like this episode. And once again, I was in a mood where I was like, I want to watch the fourth one, but I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. So I didn't. But it's a tough tone. And there's actually, in a way that I don't always... Obviously, you and I both think Aaron Sorkin's a great writer. I don't always think that his characters are difficult to interpret, right? Not to say that they're not nuanced, but they tell you what they're about. There are some characters, like small characters thus far, minor roles, that are surprisingly complicated to me. The one I'm thinking of is Elliot Hirsch, played by David Harbour, mm-hmm. who's the second anchor, who has the show afterwards.
Yeah.
And, like, he's not who I expect him to be ever. And he has very few lines. And every time he says them, I'm like, oh, that's not who I thought you were as a person. But, like, I think the show is like I said, it struggles because it's given itself a hard thing to do. It's like a gymnast who picks the more complicated thing and then maybe can only get a 7. And the gymnast who does the easier thing gets a 9.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about gymnastics. but that's what it feels like. That's the best analogy I can use, and it wasn't that good. But, like, he's setting the bar very high because this is a challenging show to pull off. But here were moments of characters that a character I like who had a moment I didn't like, and a character I like who had a moment I did like.
Okay.
I liked Maggie speaking up to Will and saying, hey, you don't have to drag all of your girlfriends or dates in front of Mackenzie.
This was a great Maggie episode.
Great Maggie episode, which was necessary after harsh, crappy treatment for her last week. But she has some real strength and confidence, and she says this thing to Will, and she's like, I know this is inappropriate, but... And Will's like, you are so wrong. And I was like, wow, she's getting schooled. And he's not being a jerk about it, but he's, like, embarrassing at the same time. And he's like, I haven't considered Mackenzie's feelings at all. And it's like, I just heard what I said. And so I liked all of that. I liked that whole moment.
That was good.
I didn't like Jim Harper. I didn't like the writing for Jim.
Yeah.
As he, like, Don, once again, a dick, ignoring the, oh, no, when she's having a panic attack, we just leave her alone. Like, mm-hmm. we just leave her to suffer. And Jim's like, no, we do something. And, like, here's what I learned in Fallujah or whatever. Like, here's my military training to help you get through this. And, by the way, here's my confident solution. You should have your Xanax with you at all times. Okay. She doesn't need to be told that. It felt poorly done.
Yeah, and he also gave her relationship advice of, like, stick with Don. That felt weird.
I agree.
Now, I think we're supposed to interpret that as, like, Jim is such a good guy that he's not trying to be selfish with this relationship. And we're supposed to look at it that way. But, like, he's in a kind of a weird position where he finds himself having to give that relationship advice to her.
I Rube Goldberg'd his motives more than you did. And I think probably wrongly now that you're talking about it. But I was like, his advice is, you should stop breaking up all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, if you want to be an adult. Because he knows that Don sucks.
Yeah.
And so I read it as, he's like, just stay with him for a little bit and see how he sucks when you stay in there for longer. And then just break up with him once and for all.
Yeah.
Like, that was what I took. Because we see that he's got this optimism. He heard now that they really did break up and mm-hmm. that this one's final. This time it's real. And then Neil is telling him, go talk to her. And he walks over there. And then there she is. Getting smoochy with Don again,
mm-hmm.
Which is, I think, fair, but again, not a service to Maggie. Like, I want better for Maggie. Don sucks. How does Maggie not know that Don sucks?
I know. I mean, if she'd been watching the show that we're watching, because his first scene in this show is when he kind of comes in. He's like, I was overserved. But the whole reason you wrote that on Arapology is to mess with me, right?
He's like, I could have done this show, but you didn't. Like, you didn't. Go away. I did think that Sam Waterston was great.
Yeah.
In all of his scenes, both with Will and like initially, I think I was misinterpreting it. And again, we've talked a lot about on this podcast about how Sorkin plays with time and uses time as a storytelling device. And I think sometimes with the intent of being a little bit confusing, but early on, it feels like we're seeing him lie to Will. We're seeing him protect Will. Mm-hmm. Like, no, nobody said anything. Everything's fine. Nobody said anything. And then it feels like he's lying because we keep seeing the intercuts of him getting yelled at and saying, what is Will doing? But then it seems like maybe he was telling the truth because nobody has anything yet and he hadn't gotten yelled at, but he clearly knew they were going to get in trouble. Like, if they're sacrificing ratings because they wanted to do a purer show, like, obviously that doesn't make any sense. As a business decision, that doesn't make any sense. But I liked his whole thing. I like how he does not care. The thing that's weird, he seems to have no fear of getting fired. He seems to have no fear of getting in trouble. And he is violent. Too many people talk about punching on this show. Too many people threaten to punch
people. A lot of them are Charlie.
Exactly. But I mean, I'll watch him all day.
I know. There was that nice couplet. I feel like we've seen that. We saw that in a couple of the movies and we pointed it out where Charlie says, I'll tell you when there's something to worry about. And then it cuts to the 44th floor of like one of those faceless suits saying, now we really got something to worry about.
Yes.
And you're like, I see. That's where you start connecting that, like, the time that conversation in the 44th floor is happening much later. It's kind of fun.
So other moments I really liked, two, and then one moment I really didn't like. Two moments that I liked. One was, we see Will realize, thanks to Maggie, he's being a jerk, and he's coming to Mackenzie to apologize, and now Mackenzie has brought Wade. Wade, who she started dating in the past 3 months, mm-hmm. and who also clearly sucks, like who she should not be dating. But I like that, in that ruining the apology for Will, and he doesn't do it, whatever. Like, that's good rom-com storytelling, and I appreciate it. I also like that. I think it was Jane Fonda who said it, but we had a classic Sorkinism of, can we have the room, please?
Yep, I wrote that one down.
A phrase he just loves. And I liked when Charlie tells Reese to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And Jane Fonda's like, Reese, you can stay. And then Charlie says, Reese, get the fuck out. I think again, or I'll punch you in the face or something. And Jane Fonda's like, okay, just go. that whole thing. She's like, yeah, he's out. Here's what I didn't like. There was the worst of West Wing cringe moment for me at the very end of this episode. The unison, God bless America. I wrote down barfy. it's not how humans talk. It's not how even proud Americans talk.
Mm-hmm.
And like the fact that they all knew to say it in unison felt so scripted and weird. Like, I could see, like, God bless America, and other people saying, yeah, God bless America, like not in unison, like a cascading of people saying it, but the full unison God bless America. It reminded me of like,
I serve like, at the pleasure of the president.
I serve the pleasure of the president, and then I serve the pleasure of the United States. Like, God, I think that happens in two different episodes and I hate it both times, but that part felt cringy to me. But I really, this was a good episode, and I'm very curious to see where I feel like I remember Jane Fonda being an ally to Charlie and to Will, but I could be misremembering.
Yeah.
So I'm very curious to see what happens with her character.
It would be great if she turned out to be more than just a one-note villain. So I'm hoping for the best there.
Yeah.
I'll mention two things. One thing.
Do it.
They mentioned Abbie Hoffman, your friend and mine, Abbie Hoffman.
My fellow Brandeis alum and Sorkin focus.
And I was looking up trivia on IMDb, sorry, Casey, about this show. And Tom Hayden from the Trial of the Chicago 7, Tom Hayden, played by Eddie Redmayne, used to be married to Jane Fonda in real life.
Ah, the real person. Yes, yeah, I saw that
not
too.
Eddie Redmayne.
Crazy.
Eddie Redmayne was not married to Eddie.
Yes, he's way too young for her. But no, I saw that too. So they reference him even to her, which is cute because I like that. That was one of two things you said you wanted to show.
Oh, no, it was just the two. Abbie Hoffman and Tom Hayden.
Got it. Oh, yeah. And who clearly are Aaron Sorkin passions. I think I am impressed at the sprawlingness of this cast, which, again, is not unusual in a Sorkin project. But, like, three episodes in, I know I was earlier referencing that some of these characters are even more nuanced than I expect them to be. But I feel like I know a lot of characters and I know a lot about them.
Yeah.
And that's very impressive to me. Like, That's not easy, and I want to, because no one's ever praised Aaron Sorkin before, I want to give him credit where due, because that's really there's something very impressive to me that we're three episodes in and we know who these people are. Like, that's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's pretty good. It's for that many.
Good ensemble. And we talk about how we hate Don so much, but like, Don's pretty well written for being.
Because he's not a cartoon.
Yeah. And he's not a key player. So we don't see him on the screen all the time. But like, we've seen him on enough to feel like he's not a one note villain to the point earlier, because every now and then he actually says something really nice or very thoughtful. But yeah, we hate him already. So that's kind of impressive. But yeah, a lot of cool people. Yeah. I know we're going to get to know Neil a little bit more too. And so I'm looking forward to that too. Because when he comes on and says more than just relationship advice, he's a pretty interesting guy. So I'm looking forward to that.
I do hate that his job is Will's blog.
Yeah.
Because that feels very dated to me. Oh, here's my social manager who's running Will's blog. Like, if Rachel Maddow has a blog, I've never seen it. If any news anchor has one, I've never seen it. That is not a thing that matters.
And
to
how
me
can
at
that
all.
Be a full-time job? Like, who gets paid a living wage writing a blog right. for someone?
Like, I feel like today he would have written it as his social media manager overall,
yeah,
but still.
That would have been a little more believable.
I don't know anything about the next episode other than it's called I'll Try to Fix You, which I assume is referencing the Coldplay song Fix You. And the IMDb photo, sorry, Casey, is of Neil. So maybe that means he's got a prominent role in this episode.
Ah, cool. Looking forward to it. Well, Lex, anything to wrap us up as we near the end of this episode, too?
Yeah, I'm going to do a freestyle rap to summarize all of my thoughts. Just kidding. I don't know. I had complaints, which I just shared on this episode, but I did like it. This felt like a show finding its groove. I really appreciated how much time went by, because it now gave me the inference as a viewer that, like, the problem with real life is it can be boring, right? Sometimes there's a slow news week. I do a tech podcast. Sometimes there's nothing to talk about in tech news. So, like, the fact that we can just skip over, okay, there was this whole election thing, Tea Party, and then the election happened, and a lot of Tea Party people won. Whoops. But it means, like, Sorkin's going to feel comfortable jumping ahead if nothing has happened in the news that he finds exciting. And I like that. Like, if we're going to be, if it's a TV show, it should be entertaining. And I don't need slow news days unless that's the whole point of the episode.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. That means we're not going to get an episode full of relationship stuff, which does feel a little bit more like the padding. And I realize we got to make these people feel human, and it can't just be about the news. And some of the most heartfelt moments in the West Wing are when we weren't really wrestling with the news. But so far, I'd say the romance stuff feels like the weakest part of this show. And it's where people seem to act a little bit more like idiots. And so I'm looking forward to where people can make more intelligent life decisions, I suppose.
That's an interesting point. And it does feel like that is part of Sorkin's overall contention, is that all of us are idiots when it comes to love and romance. There's obvious will they or won't they with Maggie and
Jim.
Jim, thank you. And then obvious with Mackenzie and Will. And my hunch is that, yes, they both will. Mm-hmm. And I get the dramatic tension and the fun and joy of the writing of making us wait a long time. The same way we had to wait a really long time for, like, CJ and Danny.
Yeah. And Josh and Donna.
Or for Josh and Donna, right?
Yeah.
Spoiler for the West Wing. But I don't mind those moments, but I agree. Like, the IQs of everybody involved drop every time that's the focus. And that's a struggle for me.
Yeah.
It's like all of a sudden John Wells wrote the episode.
Oh.
Boom. You burnt John Wells.
Now, like, I feel like President and Bartlett and Abby, like, had a pretty incredible relationship. And so, like, when they were equals, and maybe we didn't have to ever worry about will they, won't they with them, you know, because they were already together. So it's maybe the courtship that feels like a little flatter with Aaron.
Yeah, I think that's right. Well, Brian, it's been a pleasure discussing episode 3, the 112th Congress, with you. And I look forward to discussing I'll Try to Fix You. Do you know that Coldplay song?
No. I'll listen to it in between now and then.
People seem to love this song. I haven't ever read the lyrics. The lyrics that I know where he says, I will try to fix you. He doesn't use the contraction. That always seems obnoxious to me, so I'm hoping that I'm misinterpreting that song. Like, that's not the... No. No. Don't try to fix people. People are who they are. Like, fix yourself, dick. So anyway, I'm intrigued to see how that's used in this episode.
All right. Should be good. And listeners, thanks for supporting the incomparable. Thanks for hanging out with us. If you have any feedback or questions, reach out to Lex on Threads. I'm sure you can find him there. And then Sorkin at lexfriedman.com. Is that right?
That's true.
Okay, yeah. Perfect.
If you want to donate anything comparable, feel free. Theincomparable.com/members. You can pledge some dollars to us if you're already supporting them, or if you're a brand new supporter, and we'd welcome it because Max isn't free. But I think that's it. I think that's all the business we have to attend to.
You know, every time I launch the Max app, I'm just like, I get so mad.
I never deleted the HBO app, just in case it ever comes back. I still have it.
All right. Keep sorking in it, Lex.
You too, Brian.